three announcements before we get started. Immediately after this news conference, the Apollo 8 movie will be shown in this auditorium. There will be a briefing on Apollo lunar surface experiments in this auditorium at 10 a.m. tomorrow, conducted by John W. Small, chief of the Lunar Surface Projects Office here at MSC. At 1:30 p.m. in this same auditorium tomorrow, a briefing on Apollo applications by William Schneider, director of Apollo applications, NASA headquarters. We have Mr. Kranz and Mr. Holloway with us again today, and Gene will start with a summary of the shift.
Okay, the shift today was very similar to yesterday, with the exception that we made our final SPS burn, with the exception of the deorbit burn. I think, as you're aware, after we had finished the briefing last night, I went back to the control center, and we felt by then that we had a pretty good explanation as to why we had seen some of the anomalies in the propellant gauging system during the previous burns. So we lengthened the burn number 7 to 25 seconds to get some more data on the operation of the PUGS system. We briefed the crew on the why we lengthened the SPS-7 burn over Carnarvon at 165.59 in the 105th rev. Talked briefly about the weather for recovery. And the crew at that time was shooting various targets of opportunity from a photographic standpoint. They powered up over the Redstone at 166.24. And we're taking pictures during the stateside pass for various hydrology and oceanography studies. We also used them to more or less give us an airborne weather report as they passed across the states. Two interesting items. We had secured Bermuda earlier in the day because of high winds, and we didn't want to bust up any of their antenna systems. And the Vanguard at that time was experiencing 18-foot swells, and they couldn't stay locked in commsat several times during the pass. But they managed to stay up for their passes and then secured for the rest of the day. The crew was eating as they passed across Africa, and we reviewed the PUGS procedure that we were going to use for this burn in the control center. Came across Perth. Jim asked what city was over. Saw the lights down there and wished the best wishes to the people of Perth. And again, we briefed the crew. As I said, here's where we briefed the crew on the PUGS test itself. And basically what we're doing, we're taking a look at the possibility of capillary action in the sensing tubes in the propellant gauging system. Capillary action under zero-G. It's a pretty interesting explanation they've given us so far. Came across the 106th rev across the Hawaii site. Everything was going good there. We read the crew the maneuver pad, or the pre-advisory message for the SPS number 7 burn. Talked about the use of the cabin fans, and we wanted to get confirmation. Earlier in the day, at the beginning of the shift, prior to the time we came on, he reported that cabin fan did not seem to run and it seemed to be warm. We wanted to get some more confirmation on that item and find out if he was using cabin fan number 2, and apparently he wasn't. We uplinked over the states his state vector and target loads for the burn number 7. And since they were passing over their prime recovery area at that time, we gave them pointing data to look down at it. By this time in the mission, it's necessary, let's put it this way, it is not necessary for this mission, but we generally like to maintain our cryogenic tank balance within about 2%. We were off about 3% at this time, so we decided that we'd rebalance our O2 tanks. And we flew the majority of the day with the O2 heaters and tank number 1 off, tank number 2 in auto. As we were coming across the states, what we wanted to do, as going back over Carnarvon, we wanted to make sure that if we had any master alarms during SPS-7, They would all be attributable to the PUG system. If you remember, we've had some master alarms due to the condenser exhaust temperature in fuel cell number 2, and we wanted to lower that temperature, so we had the crew bring on their H2 purge line heaters and run an H2 purge to drop that temperature so we didn't have to worry about it during the burn. Crew came across over Hawaii, configured for the burn. We gave them a go over the Redstone at 169.34 and 108th rev. They made their burn on time. The MCNW gave only one indication, one master alarm, and that was 5 seconds after the burn initiated, and seemed to operate properly. Now, that's from a standpoint that it generated no further master alarms. We're continuing to look at the data today and tonight, and it's a rather long-term analysis that the people are in on the PUG system right now. The burn went exceptionally well, and we were within about 1/10 of a nautical mile of our desired orbit after we had finished the burn. And then Jim came down and told us he had added up and the fact that we had made 17 burns so far, so we thought, well, heck, we don't want him to be one up on us, so we told him that he had burned out 10,500 feet, 15 feet per second in orbit. And we had a pretty good exchange of data. You probably heard we read him as astrology to the crew today and passed him up several more pieces of information. I'll give you the exact what we measured as the terminal conditions for SPS-7. The burn was at 169 hours, 38 minutes, and 59 seconds. The delta V was 653 feet per second. The burn time was 25 seconds. Our apogee is 250 nautical miles, and our perigee is 98 nautical miles. We then went back and updated our consumables, looking towards our budgets for the next several days, and it looks like we'll be able to use about 50 pounds of propellant a day. Yesterday I reported that we had used about 21 pounds yesterday in the experiments. Over the night it settled down and we found out the crew had been more conservative than we thought. They had only used about 16 pounds. Right now we're allowing them an average of about 50 pounds a day for the remainder of the flight plan, so we have as much fuel as we need to do all of the things we're thinking about doing, plus some more. Updated them on the SO-65, particularly the Amazon River, the mouth of the Amazon River they're interested in. And that's basically about it. We finished our SO-65s. We gave them several targets of opportunity from a standpoint of their Hasselblad photos. And are now proceeding to give the crew the cryo plan for this evening, actually how we intend to manage the H2 tanks so that we don't get the master alarms during the night period. Got a small or a minor update in our present end of mission time. I understand that they have that clock over here, and I'm going to keep it up to date from now on. I haven't generally been doing it because I only work with it in a gross sense, but we're going to make sure it's reading the correct time as we get updates, and at the present time we're looking towards 238.51.53. And we'll keep that clock updated for you. Also, one other item, we ran several comm checks with the Araya over the Pacific between the Guam site and Hawaii on the last rev at around 172 hours and 30 minutes, and the communications were excellent today, so we're going to have to, they must have really been tweaking up their system because it was really coming in good. That's all we have.
Okay, Nelson Benton.
You talked about weather in the recovery area. What consideration are you giving to bringing the flight down early because of the bad weather?
None at the present time. I think it's much too early to speculate in that area right now. They have a high pressure area over the continental United States, and they don't have any other major frontal activity. And what they're doing is they're looking towards more the climatology type of forecast as to what's going to happen if that high moves, and it's, I think, much too early to speculate as to what our weather in the recovery area is going to be.
Well, are you not doing any discussion of an alternate recovery area
not
other than just
the present time? I think we're going to seriously start looking at that activity tomorrow, I would say. I think we need better forecasts before we start talking about bringing it down, because if we're going to bring it down, we're going to want to get more activity accomplished, try to wrap up all our SO-65s and ram in some P-22s, that type of stuff. At the present time, we have no reason to bring it down earlier.
Go ahead right here, John.
Well, we've been told that the weather limitations as far as NASA is concerned are 8-foot swells and 28-knot winds. Now, what happens if you have 20-knot winds and 12-foot swells? Does either one of these have to be out of whack?
Well, we've got many options. We can move the recovery areas downrange, uprange. We can pick an entirely different revolution. That's why I say it's much too early to make that type of decision, because you have to have more information to work on.
But before you make the decision to move it, how do you play around with these limitations you have on seas and winds?
Generally, we take and use the evaluation of the on-site recovery commander, whether he feels that the weather is satisfactory for recovery. We have some gross numbers, but generally it's his evaluation and the recovery organization we've got in-house, their evaluation of whether they have suitable areas for recovery. And then they get together with the retrofire controllers. In fact, they do this daily. Each day we're making minor adjustments in our deorbit targets as a function of weather. In fact, if you took a look right at the beginning of the mission, we had some pretty lousy areas in some of our prime recovery areas, and we were redesignating areas all over the Earth at that time. So it's really up to the recovery people to get together with the retrofire controllers, and they'll establish the deorbit points, deorbit targets.
Harry P.
Is there any other kind of an engine anomaly that could light off that master control and warning that the PUGS lights off?
Yeah, there are several parameters tied into the MC&W system, but all of those parameters we have analog measurements on, and they're all behaving properly.
Well, the thing I was wondering about, you told them that this master control and warning light probably would come on, ignore it.
Yes.
What if it hadn't been the PUGS that caused it?
Well, they go back and reset that master warning light, which essentially clears that indication until they either have another PUGS output that says, I'm going to give you a master warning. So as soon as they clear it, that system can accept inputs from any of its other sensors. Okay, in addition to that, that's the master warning indication. They still have the MC&W panel itself that tells them which discrete event has triggered that master alarm.
And, Gene, if I might add something there, I'm sure the LMP had his eyeballs peeled on that one up through the entire barn. So he would have said, yes, that was caused by the PUG system.
They would have detected it if it had been a drop in thrust chamber pressure or something like that.
That's right. Yeah. They have, plus the fact they have analog measurements on the board.
Mark Bloom.
They use for that purpose.
Got a couple of questions. One, were there any private conversations today?
No.
Okay. Number two.
Not in my shift.
Number two is about the horoscopes. And I was just wondering why they were sent up. Are one of the guys up there, is he an astrology nut, or is there somebody on the ground who is?
I don't know. A lot of times that you'll find out that they'll be one up on you, so you'll look for some way to get one up on them, and this just seemed to be pretty good to pass up. It seems just a pretty interesting one for three guys cooped up in a spacecraft. I don't know who sent it even to us.
It came over from the news center.
Did it? Okay.
Yeah. Came along with the news reports we had asked for. I don't know here. Tom?
James.
Wait for the mic, please.
What's this capillary action business in zero G you were talking about? Describe that a little bit.
Well, let's put it this way. I think before I really get in over my head on this, and it'll be very easy to do. Apparently, this capacitance probe they use is a tube that sticks up through the bottom of the tank. Okay? And it's filled with fluid when the tanks are full. Well, what they're theorizing is that as the tank's empty, okay, fluid is actually moving up the tube, just true normal capillary action. Okay? And that after a period of time, you've got a false and erroneous indication, okay, on one of your parameters.
Okay, and it takes a while for that indication. See, we were very interested in this because all of the previous burns we had had master alarms on, we didn't have ullage on. So if there wasn't a capillary action, it wouldn't tend to drive it back down and settle it, okay, with the rest of the propellant. This was the first burn that we had any ullage on, and we wanted to find out how that would affect this particular indication. Okay, I'm sure that as we review this more throughout the night, and particularly the data we got today, I think we'll have a better feel for it as to whether we do or do not have a problem, and if anything, what minor changes we ought to make. We don't know.
One other question. That's about today's burn to bring it up into a higher apogee. And the reason given the other day, I think you said it, Jack, that we need a freer fall when you come down. Could you describe that and go into that just a little bit?
Yeah, basically what we want, the crew has to, from the time they deorbit, okay, until they hit the sensible atmosphere, they have many things to do. They have to configure the spacecraft for reentry. They want to jettison the service module. They want to turn around into attitude and essentially be in attitude before they hit the sensible atmosphere. There's a lot of work on board the spacecraft, and if you take a look at the checklist, you'll see how many steps are actually involved in configuring the spacecraft for CMSM separation. You want to give the crew the longest period of time prior to the time they hit the atmosphere to get that job done. That's basically what they're doing. The other thing was they wanted to be able to accomplish that, you also want to put your apogee, not only bring it up, but you want to put it in the southern hemisphere. So that's exactly the way we're going to be for...
It's in apogee at the time it's coming down, or just before it comes down.
Yeah, about the time you're retrofiring.
Two quick almanac things. That time that you mentioned as a possible... That was a retrofire time, right?
Yes.
The 238,
yes.
So on.
Yes.
Retrofire time. The other was, do we know what this volcano's name is?
Tommy?
The one in Costa Rica?
Apparently, I'm a little confused. There seem to be mention of one in Costa Rica and one in Mexico, too.
Yes, the volcano he observed that you heard over the air to ground was near Mexico City, and I was told the name of it, and quite frankly, I can't pronounce it, and I didn't write it down. And the one in the...
I think the query desk got the name of the one in Costa Rica. It's Orinal or something like
that. Can I go back to the previous question in the orbit we're in right now? That is really optimized in case we should have an SPS failure and have to use our RCS to get down. See, that's really optimized for the rev after our normal deorbit so that we can come down with our RCS. That's why you want it there. That's where you're going to fire, yes.
Bill?
I've got another question on the deorbit burn. At that time, you will be coming down from apogee, is that correct, at the time that you burn for deorbit?
Yes, you'll be moving towards
Do you know approximately, or exactly if you have it, what the altitude will be at the time you initiate burn?
No, I could find this out, and we could get the answer very quickly for you. In fact, I think right after we finish here, we can give you the answer.
Would you?
Mind me to get that. We can also get the latitude. Are you interested in that information? We can get the latitude, longitude, and the whole smash for you.
Any of those parameters would be great,
okay.
I think.
Have you got that to the phone over there? Why don't you ask them for the altitude, lat, and longitude of the orbit retrofire.
Gene, have you always done this when your manned flights come down from apogee?
Well, actually, we come down, if I remember right, generally post-apogee, some true anomaly within about 30 to 45 degrees.
Now, is this the first flight on which you put them up this high to give them the longer downhill run?
No, we generally try to set up the orbit in this fashion. Okay.
Has it ever been up to 250 before?
I don't remember what our maximum altitude has been before, but we have gone eccentric, and we always have attempted to move apogee to the southern hemisphere.
So the principle has been applied before, but maybe could this be the highest apogee you've chosen? I can't remember any being anywhere near this high.
I don't particularly remember. Yeah. Pardon?
Go ahead. A couple of questions. Two things. One, to follow up what you mentioned. You mentioned a couple of options, and I know this iffy on the weather, so I'm not forcing you to say you're going to do these, but what can you go over and how far over your planned splash time?
Okay,
because of weather, would you do that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. We've, in fact, if you take a look at the way we juggle our target points around as a function of where the front is, we move them downrange and uprange, and this is a function of how far the recovery forces can move in a certain period of time. In other words, how long do we want to make the decision is really the key item, because this lets the recovery guys, they have to come in and say, okay, in that case, I can move my carrier so many hundred miles. Okay, so really we've got several options, and in previous missions, sometimes we've even put the carrier in between revolutions because the weather, we really couldn't decide which rev we wanted to come in on as a function of weather, and we'd wait until the last possible minute. And if the weather's poor, you're going to find that's the same thing that we're going to be doing here. Pardon?
Could it be a day, say, added?
No. I doubt if we're, in fact, we wouldn't add a day onto the mission. We generally either go further downrange, okay, if we can get out of it that way, and we'll go a distance commensurate with the capability of the recovery forces to move. Or we may pick a different revolution, one earlier or one later. But right now, like I say, it's too early to speculate on this particular case because we don't have a definite indication of what the weather is going to be, and therefore we can't set up a plan as to what we're going to do.
On another topic, you mentioned
Gemini 9.
You had enough fuel to do everything planned plus some more. I wonder if you're planning on adding some.
No,
more.
I think, in fact, I was talking to Tommy when I come over here. We're going to get a good hack on it tonight. And generally, we say here's targets of opportunity, which means if you're in that attitude, okay, if you're in an attitude conducive to taking a picture when you fly over the spot, take it. I think what we're going to do is say, for the targets of opportunity, you can use attitude control fuel as necessary to be in the attitude at that time. So I think that's the kind of openings we're going to give the crew. Plus the fact they're being very, very cautious and conservative as to how they use it, and I think we're going to allow them to loosen it up a bit.
Right. Gene, this close look at the weather that you're going to make tomorrow, about what time of the day will you make it? Early in the day, on the off chance you might want to come down a day early and want to pack up the flight plan, or in other words, about what time should we start really looking for information?
I don't know. I think from what I've seen so far, I think tomorrow's weather look is probably going to be as inconclusive as today's is.
You'll probably stay on a day-by-day basis,
yeah,
then.
I think it's going to be on a day-by-day basis.
Mm-hmm. But you would do it reasonably early in the day, wouldn't you? You'd start looking at this thing fairly early.
I'd say as soon as we get a hold on the flight plan, sometime when it doesn't appear there's too much activity going on, I'd speculate myself that it'd be early tomorrow.
Right, thank you.
Could I go back to the ullage discussion we were having yesterday?
Sure. And ullage?
Yes, we were talking about that burn where you didn't have ullage. Once you light that big engine, don't you get automatic ullage?
Oh, you sure do.
Well, then why would you be worried about helium getting down into the tank?
Okay, but what you have to do is you have solid propellant essentially from what they call the outer screens through the zero-G can. Actually, you have a good-sized chunk of propellant. I forget what the exact time is, but generally in the mission rules we use from 7 to 10 seconds of solid propellant down there. Now, we'll use this up for the start. It has no helium in it. In the meantime, you have propellant dispersed throughout the tanks. They're going to be moving down towards the bottom of the tank, and there's a possibility you may entrap some helium. Have him give it to me for the time, excuse me. Have him give me the longitude and altitude for the 238, 51, 53 he gave me earlier when I came over. Okay, anyway, during the period of time that you're under thrust, there's a possibility that you could entrain or entrap some helium and actually drive it through the screens into the engine area. I think the prime concern they've got is not for that particular burn, as Neil stated, but actually the cutoff after that burn possibly having some helium in there, where it could get down in the area of the ball valves or in the area of the injector and cause a mismatch between the fuel and oxidizer leads. Okay, that's the prime concern they've got.
Yeah, we got that, and as we got to talking it over, we began to wonder what happened when you got the ullage from the rocket fire itself. It looked as though that would pack the fuel down solid with no helium.
It will, but it's also the possibility that that helium has to settle out somewhere, and what you'd prefer to do, okay, was to put it under a low acceleration until you get the bulk of the propellant settled before you increase the thrust. Just a function of how well you eliminate the helium.
I see. In other words, you can squeeze the helium out better with the normal ullage procedure than you can just firing up the rocket.
That's right.
Go ahead. In other words, simply super ullage is as bad as no ullage at all.
No, we're not.
uh,
If you want the truth, we really don't know. When you say super ullage, that let's put it this way. Corporately, okay, and operationally, I would prefer to have a four-jet ullage if I've got enough fuel to do it. If I don't have enough fuel to do it, I'll go down to a two-jet ullage, okay, for a longer period of time. If it gets down to the point where I have to make engine burns, okay, from a flight safety point where it gets more unsafe not to light it, okay, than it is to light it, I'm going to burn it. And I have confidence that that engine's going to burn. And I believe the majority of the people that are used to working with it have confidence that it's going to burn.
Have any of the crew members been taking any medicines or pills or anything else to sleep?
Not to our knowledge. I don't know if we got...
We had a report this
morning.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And I think... it's in the transcript. One had one active fed, and all three of them had a vitamin pill, and that's it. Yeah. I forget who had the active fed.
Right.
Yeah. Harry P. So.
That was before Harry I came P. on.
Now that you're committed to your final orbit, that is... before deorbit, if you want to change oceans, do you have to shift 8 revs forward or backward? And you always come out at perigee, don't you? So
reasonably close to it, yes.
So there, if you were going to land in the Pacific instead of the Atlantic, you'd have to make a half day's time change in your landing. Is that right?
Well, I think you'd have your normal regression of the orbits, if I understand your question. You would have a delay of about 4 to 6 revolutions as a function of which revolution you wanted to pick. But I believe the orbit would still be satisfactory for deorbit.
John?
If I remember the weather forecast for the Pacific from Saturday correctly,
well,
at least as Saturday, it didn't seem to be much different than the forecast for the Atlantic.
No, today's weather, if I remember right, and I'm sure that you probably get some weather maps over here, it looked pretty good in the dash 4 areas.
For Thursday.
I don't look at the projections for Thursday in the Pacific at the present time. Like I say, I have no reason to look in that direction at the present time.
One of the wire services says that the astronauts saw some strange lights about the time of the SPS burn. I couldn't see anything like that in the transcript.
And I didn't hear anything.
Do you recall any reports of strange lights?
Strange lights.
The only reports of lights that I recall are the lights they saw in Australia. So they saw a lot of lights.
Yeah, that wasn't around the SPS.
Right. Yeah. Ed, you have a question?
Gene, could we recap on why you like to come down from apogee, please? It gives them a longer downhill run, more time to do things. But is there some other reason for firing at apogee?
Yeah,
doesn't take any less energy to deorbit just because you're at apogee, does it? You still got to kill the same kinetic energy.
Generally, you can bring your perigee down further, which you'll note that we have done. Okay, and essentially keep, let's put it this way, you don't get to a point where your orbit's decaying rapidly on you. So I think that's the case you're talking about.
Nevertheless, you want a low safe perigee.
Pardon?
You nevertheless want a low, relatively safe perigee.
Yeah, yes.
Get down.
Yes.
In that connection, you want a low...
I think I'll bring a retrofire officer next time through.
You want a low perigee because in the case you have to use the RCS as a backup for the SPS?
That's right.
So you have two considerations, a high apogee to give them a longer fall time to get things done, and a low perigee or a lower perigee so you can use the RCS.
Less delta V. See, the case is where generally to get at the present time, we're running about 1G acceleration on the engine, where you're running significantly less on the RCS. So it will take several minutes of burn time on the RCS as you're driving down from apogee. So you're actually burning up a lot of that time before you can actually start your preparation for separation and turnaround.
Now, is this your philosophy on all deorbits, what you've described
this
here
is
today?
This is generally what we have done for the majority of the Earth orbital missions,
right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Even back into the Gemini program for a while.
How up to what point do you have
to drop your perigee to get a reentry?
I believe it's around 50 nautical miles. Once they get below that point, they're sure they're going to reenter.
You mean without help?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Did we get those numbers on the latitude and longitude and time?
He's on the phone here now, Bill, trying to get them.
Retro fire officer today.
Yeah, I'm going to get a retro fire officer.
I'm trying to